This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Abyss. That is the abyss from which there is no return. Those the words of the late Senator Frank Church in 1975, who convened the Church Committee hearings to challenge this level of total surveillance. And that's the quote that Jim Bamford ends his piece with in the New York Review of Books. I want to thank you both for being with us for this hour. James Bamford, investigative reporter who's covered the National Security Agency for 3 decades, helped expose the NSA's existence in the 80s. His most recent book, The Shadow Factory, The Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to the Eavesdropping on America. His most recent piece in the New York Review of Books, They Know Much More Than You Think. And thanks so much to Spencer Ackerman, National Security Editor at The Guardian. We'll link to your piece as well. It's called U.S. Government Declassifies Court Order on NSA Surveillance as Pressure Builds. Our website is democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
It's 5 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland, and the p.m. news is next.
Pickathon is an innovative music experience happening from Friday, August 2nd through Sunday, August 4th, just outside of Portland at the beautiful Pendarvis Farm. This one-of-a-kind weekend of music, food, and community features performing artists Sharon Van Etten, The Devil Makes Three, Sally Ford and The Sound Outside, The Foghorn String Band, and many, many more. Information about tickets, camping, and other performers can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Dr. Robert Amajoy and the Northwest Center for Colorectal Health, LLC, providing screening colonoscopy to help prevent colorectal cancer as well as minimally invasive management of colorectal disease. Offices in Portland and Milwaukee. Detailed information at 503-216-5380 or nwcch.com. This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, a House committee hearing explores allegations that whistleblowers at the Bonneville Power Administration faced retaliation for uncovering discriminatory hiring practices.
As federal lawmakers advance legislation expanding timber sales nationwide, a blockade on a proposed clear cut in southern Oregon continues towards its third month.
And a new lawsuit in Virginia challenges the state's ban on same-sex marriage as similar challenges pop up in states around the U.S. following recent victories in the Supreme Court.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, August 1st, 2013.
The House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform held a hearing today as part of an investigation into the Pacific Northwest-based federal agency Bonneville Power Administration, or BPA, which sells power to regional public utilities. The hearing focused on allegations that whistleblowers within BPA faced retaliation, including termination, after complaining about hiring practices that discriminated against veterans in violation of federal hiring standards. Since reports of whistleblower reprisals surfaced in mid-July, the U.S. Department of Energy has stepped in to take control of BPA's Human Resources Authority and suspended the agency's chief operating officer and administrator. The Department of Energy has launched its own investigation into the allegations, the results of which are due soon, and for now have put into place a new BPA acting administrator who has been unpopular in the past with some regional utilities. During today's hearing, the Department of Energy's Deputy Secretary denied involvement with the stifling of whistleblower complaints, but said that, based on his initial findings, it's possible the allegations are true in at least half a dozen cases. Suspended BPA COO Anita Decker testified that the disciplinary actions in those cases were based on performance issues, not retaliation for whistleblowing. As for the discriminatory hiring practices at the heart of the debate, Ms. Decker argued that BPA had enforced hiring practices improperly, but did not specifically target veterans, pointing to cases in which veterans were unaffected.
In regard to H.R. 1526, the Restoring Healthy Forests for Healthy Communities Act, it claims to address the failures of forest management and county funding on the part of the BLM and the federal government in general over the past 20 years or so. It claims that the bill would positively affect the spread of wildfires and bark beetle epidemics that have sort of gone wild in the past 20 years. What would your response to that be?
Well, I think it's a little bit of a misnomer to call this bill a forest health management bill. It's really about getting up the cut to increase revenues for county governments that have long been subsidized by federal lands logging. It's a turn away from science-based management. It's a turn away from what the Oregon public and broader American public thinks we should be using our public lands for, which is multi-use, recreation, clean water, clean air. And it really is about going back to 1980s-style forest management.
What would characterize 1980s-style forest management?
Well, today, when you drive through the Coast Range from, you know, say the Willamette Valley out to Newport, what you see is a mix of public lands that are largely forested and somewhat protected, with a mix of private lands, which have been clear cut. Anyone that's driven out to the Coast Range knows what I'm talking about, and that private industry model is to clear cut every 30 or 40 years and to think about the forest only as a profit center. And that's the style of forest management that we would see under this new bill proposed by Representative DeFazio and Representative Hastings. It's a throwback to that idea that all we can see the forest for is profit from cutting it down.
Would it be a long-term source of revenue and jobs?
Well, I think it's important to look at history here and sort of see where we've been with logging in Oregon and the boom-bust cycles that we've seen from industry. We overlogged throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s and paid the price when we realized that we were driving species to extinction, dirtying our drinking water, et cetera. And so certainly you can cut more off of these lands, but you're going to pay the price in all sorts of other ways, whether it's, you know, more filtration for drinking water or a loss in tourism and recreation economies. So, you know, it's not as simple as saying we can log our way out of every single county funding crisis. That's what we've done in the past, and it's time to look for a different model, and this bill just isn't it.
All right. And do you know of any oversight that the bill would provide for timber companies?
Well, that's the real big problem with this bill is, you know, currently on federal public lands that all Americans own, there are checks and balances to make sure that multiple values are considered. And so you have these federal environmental laws that are a safeguard against abuse. On private lands, we don't have that same safeguard. And this bill would basically say, we don't need to worry about any of the federal environmental laws, Endangered Species, Clean Water Act, anything else. We're just going to go cut it. And so you take out that public oversight and basically make these lands like private lands when in fact they're owned by all Americans.
And to be clear, the Endangered Species Act and Clean Water Act would not apply?
Yes, that's correct. This legislation has specific clauses that would exempt it from those landmark federal environmental laws like the Endangered Species Act, Clean Water Act, and others.
This current law would jack up the amount of board feet that would be cut from 200 million to 500 million. And I was wondering if you knew if that 200 million was even board feet that have been cut, or if it was just what was mandated.
Yeah, this is a common misperception, I think, about federal lands logging, that somehow the forests have been shut down. In fact, since the Northwest Forest Plan was adopted in the mid-90s, the BLM and Forest Service have met their Congress-mandated timber targets almost entirely. And so this idea that there's gridlock and that we need to jack up the harvest because promises were broken, it's a farce, it's not true, and it's long since time that we dispel that myth.
Mr. Stevens, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Sam.
For KBOO Evening News, this is Sam Bowman.
That was Sean Stevens, the president of Oregon Wild, explaining that a large federal forest bill that would greatly increase timber harvests on federally owned land in western Oregon passed the House Natural Resources Committee on Wednesday. The bill, sponsored by GOP Congressman Doc Hastings of Washington State, would increase logging across the nation and includes legislation drafted by three Oregonians, Democrats Peter DeFazio and Kurt Schrader, and Republican Greg Walden. Their contribution, dubbed the O&C Trust Act, would place 1.6 million acres of land, now controlled by the Federal Bureau of Land Management, or BLM, into a trust that would be managed for industrial logging. That legislation aims to create jobs and revenue for Oregon's struggling timber counties. The federal bill would also reinstitute the currently suspended Secure Rural Schools subsidies to these counties. If the bill passes the House, it will be considered in Senate negotiations, where Oregon Senator Ron Wyden plans to introduce his own less environmentally controversial O&C bill. The House bill has generated a heated response from statewide environmental groups.
As federal lawmakers advance legislation that would increase timber sales across the nation, including in Oregon, the environmentalist group Cascadia Forest Defenders continues a tree sit and blockade on proposed timber sale land in southern Oregon. Occupiers with the White Castle tree sit, located near Myrtle Creek, Oregon, aim to block the proposed 190-acre White Castle variable retention harvest, which they call a thinly veiled clear cut, targeting dwindling old-growth forests. The blockade began in early June and is now nearing its third month. Today I spoke with Mary Grace with Cascadia Forest Defenders for an update on the tree sit and on opposition to the proposed project. First of all, I just wanted to ask about the progress of the White Castle tree sit. How many folks are currently participating in the tree sit?
Oh, I'd say there's probably about 30 people coming and going from occupying the site, and probably another 30 people that are involved back in civilization.
What's been the response to the tree sit since it began in June, either by law enforcement or by the public?
You know, there's been a lot of public support, especially from the Myrtle Creek area. There was a lot of resistance to this planned timber harvest when it was initially proposed. So some of those folks have come forward to, you know, help supply food, information. We've been gathering a lot of local information about the site. There's a lot of people that recreate up there. We've also had daily visits, practically daily visits, from a BLM officer. They've been friendly and supportive, just reminding us of fire safety and things like that.
The proposed timber sale in the area is referred to as a variable retention harvest, which proponents of the sale claim is more environmentally sensitive than clear cutting for various reasons. What's the validity of that argument?
It's really not valid. I mean, just because you make a clear cut smaller doesn't mean it's not a clear cut. I think that any 10-year-old can see a big empty patch where there used to be trees and say, gosh, they cut them all. It's clear cut, right? And then with a variable retention harvest, that's exactly what they're doing. They're making little clear cuts, and in between them, they're leaving, you know, little clumps of trees where they don't cut anything, and then there are also areas where they're just thinning. So even though they're not logging all of this beautiful native forest that's never been logged before, they're still taking big chunks out of it. They're ruining the connectivity of old growth and you know, very large old Doug firs, among other species, that are used for nests by red tree voles, which are the main food for owls. You know, when you ruin the connectivity between trees, you break up the habitat for this animal, and you have a huge impact on the ecosystem. They're saying that this pilot project is supposed to create more butterfly habitat. First of all, the proposed cut area is full of chinkapin trees, which are prime habitat for the yellow hair streak butterfly. So there's already a lot of butterfly habitat there. And secondly, there's plenty of clearcuts that they could just stop spraying if they wanted to create more butterfly habitat. It's really just a big excuse to keep logging, because forest management has really failed on the modern scale, and the industry is just not willing to accept that, I think, is part of what's at stake here.
How would you encourage interested public to voice their opinion on this issue or to get involved if they so choose?
So there's one big thing that people could do, whether they're, you know, anywhere in Oregon. If you go to the BLM website, there's a proposed action. You should be able to look it up under proposed actions to close the roads going in to White Castle to everything but BLM traffic and people who have rights to that land, i.e. the scientists involved in the sale and the timber company, which I think is Roseburg Lumber, that bought the timber. So there's a comment period, and it's going to be from August 1st to August 30th about whether or not the public supports closing those roads, so that their rationale is that this is in order to keep timber protesters safe, which somehow I doubt is really at the bottom of their hearts their motive for wanting to keep us out of that stand of trees. It would be great for people to go and comment from wherever they're coming from, whatever their angle is on it, about how they feel about, you know, keeping those roads open and allowing this peaceful act of civil disobedience to continue. What else? We could always use donations of food. If people want to donate food to us, you can always email us at forestdefensenow@gmail.com. You can also check out our website, which is forestdefensenow.com. We love having the more people involved, the more the merrier. This is a really interesting time in forest politics. People are facing like the last grasp of the greedy, profit-driven segment of industrial society trying to get it while it's good. And it's important not to let that happen, because if we do, there's not going to be anything left.
I've been speaking with Mary Grace with the Cascadia Forest Defenders, who have orchestrated the White Castle Tree Sit. This has been Jen Chavez for KBOO News.
The Oregon State Attorney General's office has asked Multnomah County to stop releasing records relating to County Chair Jeff Kogan's affair with a county employee. The State Department of Justice fears that the continued release and publication of these documents could interfere with their ongoing investigation into the affair. The investigation aims to determine if Kogan broke any state criminal laws in his affair with Sonia Manjas, the county health department's policy and planning manager. The county has already released numerous emails, travel schedules, and expense records pertaining to the affair to area news organizations. Some of the records show that Kogan and Manjas conferred about policy issues outside of the chain of command. Kogan has so far refused to resign, despite a county board vote last week requesting that he step down, in which Kogan cast the only dissenting vote, and a board meeting today in which two members of the public stood up to demand his resignation.
You are listening. KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News after this newscast, followed by Wisdom of the Elders at 6 with culture and wisdom from Native American elders. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio News and Views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy with possible drizzle in the morning, but it ought to clear up for sunny afternoon skies and a high near 71 degrees. Tomorrow night will be mostly cloudy with lows falling to around 57 degrees.
It's just about 5:19. Time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Want to see pure altruism in action? Go to Washington, D.C. not to the marbled buildings of the federal government, but to the real city where ordinary folks live. There, you'll find a business organization that wants nothing more than to serve the people, help improve lives, and be a generous neighbor. That selfless organization is Walmart. With 6 big box stores planned for D.C., the corporation's regional manager wants people to know that Walmart's intentions truly are philanthropic. "We wish only to bring more jobs, shopping options, and fresh food choices," he recently declared, "as well as to expand access and opportunity, create a job training program, and support nonprofits." Alas, though, this Mother Teresa of global retailing is now wailing that its generosity has been spurned by an impudent city council that says it's not interested in corporate pretensions of charity, but in tangible fairness. Council members have had the audacity to pass a Large Retailer Accountability Act that would require Walmart to pay fair wages to its D.C. employees. The stipulated wage floor is $12.50 an hour, or about $25,000 a year in gross pay, which is not much in this very expensive city. In response, Walmart threw off its altruism mask, revealing the low-wage, miserly scowl for which it is globally infamous. That nice regional manager turned nasty, sputtering that the giant retailer couldn't afford such extravagance, and he threatened to abandon the city if the fair wage law is not repealed. This is Jim Hightower saying, afford? Walmart is the most profitable corporation in America, bagging $17 billion in profits last year. Yet it routinely pays its workers so poorly that they have to take food stamps and other support from us taxpayers. Hey, D.C., tell them goodbye and good riddance.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
The U.S. House of Representatives has, just last night, passed a bill lowering student loan interest rates. The bill prevents a major increase in interest rates on student loans that would have made it virtually impossible for millions of former students to be able to make their monthly payments. But in a compromise with House Republicans, Democrats agreed to partially tie the interest rates to market rates, which would be an increase from the current policy of setting fixed rates for student loans each year. But the newly passed bill does prevent the variable interest rates that could go as high as 10%. The current rate is set at 3.85%. The student loan interest rate bill will now go to President Obama for his signature.
Oregon Democratic Senator Ron Wyden and others met today with President Obama to discuss concerns with the National Security Administration, or NSA, and the Secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance, or FISA, court. Wyden has been one of the most vocal opponents in Congress of the NSA's recently exposed secret surveillance of Americans' phone records and web activity. These activities are given legal backing by the FISA court, which holds its hearings in secret and without public representation. Wyden and fellow Oregon Democratic Senator Jeff Merkley are among a dozen senators backing a bill proposed by Ron Blumenthal of Connecticut, which would drastically reorder the FISA court. The bill would add judges of varying ideological backgrounds and institute a special advocate who would be present during deliberations to question the necessity and constitutional validity of surveillance approvals. Wyden stressed the need to, quote, unstack the deck, end quote, in the secret court. Though details of the meeting with President Obama have not been made public at this hour, Wyden has said that he feels the president is open to ideas on reforming the FISA court, despite the administration's stated desire to keep the NSA's surveillance programs intact. The meeting comes the day after another massive government surveillance program, ex-Keystore, was revealed by the British Guardian newspaper. The newly revealed surveillance program goes far beyond the PRISM program, which collects metadata from millions of emails. It tracks all web traffic and searches, as well as cross-checking phone conversations and chat logs for keywords and patterns.
A Massachusetts family faced a visit from armed members of the Joint Terrorism Task Force this weekend after researching pressure cookers online. Writer Michelle Catalano said that her searches for a new pressure cooker, along with her husband's online searches for a new backpack and their son's online news browsing, apparently combined to make the family seem suspicious to the federal government. But the Obama administration continues to deny tracking anything other than metadata on emails and search logs, not the content of the searches themselves. However, the newly revealed X-Keyscore surveillance program tracks much more than metadata, including the content of searches on Google. Catalano told reporters that the officers who came to her family home told her that groups of armed officers in black SUVs regularly storm and search Americans' homes up to 100 times a week, according to the officers. They also told her that 99 out of 100 of these searches come up with nothing at all. Analysts point out, however, that the fact that a black SUV filled with federal and local officers could come up to a person's home at any time based on what words they searched for on the internet will have a chilling effect on freedom of speech and association, as well as violating the Fourth Amendment's ban on unnecessary search and seizure.
In Florida over the weekend, police shot and wounded an unarmed black man who was standing in his mother's driveway. The 60-year-old man had gone outside to grab a pack of cigarettes that he'd left in the car, and neighbors called the police, saying that they suspected a possible car theft. But when sheriffs arrived on the scene, they did not give the man time to identify himself before they began shooting. They fired a total of 6 bullets at Roy Middleton, including one that lodged in his thigh and will require the insertion of a metal rod. The incident follows the recent acquittal of a white neighborhood watch volunteer who shot and killed unarmed 16-year-old Trayvon Martin, also in Florida. In Portland this week, leaders of the city's black community held a forum to discuss their reactions to the acquittal of Trayvon Martin's killer, George Zimmerman, and to talk about moving forward to address the deep problem of racism in U.S. society.
You know, this conversation has been happening for years and it continues to happen. So having this conversation that you spoke to, it's the same conversation that a mother had with her daughter saying, you know, be prepared, the master's gonna come for you one day. This is how you need to prepare yourself. This is what's gonna happen, and I have to be frank with you in that, you know, this is what, let me prepare you for this. The same conversation that a father has with his son, do not look at a white woman ever. Do not, you know, the same conversation that my parents had with me around, you know, being safe, and that, you know, there's a very likelihood that you will get pulled over and be taken to jail for something real inconsequential that you did not deserve to happen to you. And, you know, we cannot continue to have these conversations 50 years from now. Like, that cannot happen. So we have to figure out what do we need to do to change that conversation to where the folks that are in authority, the system is they're the ones having those conversations and figuring out what they need to do differently, and not us figuring out how do we protect our children, but the system figuring out how do they protect all of us that are in the society.
You know, sometimes when you have somebody die in your life, everybody who ever died comes and visits you, and you remember all the deaths. This was like remembering all the things in my life that have resulted in people either dying or being punished or being put in jail because of their color. One of the early stories I have from my grandmother was about Marian Anderson singing in the rain because the Daughters of the American Revolution would not let her sing in Constitution Hall. That was a mild story. Another early story was of a woman in Mississippi who was pregnant and lynched and eviscerated so that her child died as she was lynched. So from not being able to sing in Constitution Hall all the way to killing a woman and her child, those are far apart, but they're a consistent movement. They are part of the same package. I was distressed, I was sad, I was angry, and for a while I felt hopeless. And it took me about 2 days to get over that feeling of hopelessness. Because if I get hopeless, I lose. If I feel helpless, I lose, and I know that. And so my job was to bring myself back to life and to start to think about this.
Those were speakers at this week's forum in Portland on the killing of Trayvon Martin, the acquittal of the man who killed him, and ways to address the problem of racism in the U.S. and here in Portland.
A woman who sued the credit reporting agency Equifax after the company refused to remove false information from her credit report has received $18 million in a settlement. Julie Miller sued Equifax after she was denied a line of credit in 2009. She spent a year trying to get false information removed from her credit report, including incorrect birth dates and Social Security numbers. The case could have wide-ranging implications, as some studies suggest that up to 20% of consumers in the United States have credit reports containing erroneous information.
The American Civil Liberties Union filed a lawsuit today in Virginia to challenge the state's continued ban on same-sex marriage. Following the recent Supreme Court ruling that provides for marriage equality at the federal level, civil liberties activists have launched a number of campaigns in the 37 states that still ban same-sex marriage. For more on the Virginia lawsuit, KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Amanda Goad, a staff attorney with the ACLU.
I wonder if you can start by telling us about the lawsuit that your group filed today in Virginia challenging that state's continued ban on gay marriage.
Sure. The ACLU, together with the ACLU of Virginia and Lambda Legal, jointly filed a new lawsuit this morning in federal district court for the Western District of Virginia. This is a class action suit seeking to bring the freedom to marry to all same-sex couples in Virginia. The class action meaning that we seek to represent not only the two couples named in the case, but also all the couples who would like to marry in Virginia, as well as all the same-sex couples in Virginia who are already married elsewhere, but currently their marriages are not respected by their home state.
Now, doesn't the recent Supreme Court ruling allowing gay marriage supersede state law?
I don't think that's really fair to say. The ACLU was very proud of our victory in the Windsor case, which struck down part of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, and that means that the federal government is now respecting same-sex marriages that were validly entered into in various states and other jurisdictions. But there are still a lot of problems out there for Americans living in the 37 states that don't yet have freedom to marry. And that's typified by one of the couples named as plaintiffs in our lawsuit, Victoria Kidd and Christy Burgoff. Christy is a federal employee. She lives in Winchester, Virginia, and works in the District of Columbia. And when she's at the office in D.C., she's legally married. But on her commute home, her marriage effectively dissolves. When she gets home to her wife and baby, ironically, she is legally in the status of single mother.
Well, and of course, Oregon is one of those states that has a ban on gay marriage written into the Constitution. Would this case in Virginia have any implication for us?
Well, it's possible, but Oregon is another exciting place where the ACLU and others are pursuing a different strategy for bringing the freedom to marry to Oregonians, and that's the ballot campaign that's coming up for 2014. And so we expect that our Virginia lawsuit may take years to resolve, and I'm pretty optimistic that Oregon is going to see results at the ballot before then.
Now, Virginia was one of the first states or colonies at the time to ban interracial marriages and one of the last to allow interracial marriages. Do you see similarities from that struggle to this struggle for marriage equality today?
Well, there are some similarities, and I think one obvious similarity is that the ultimate resolution of the controversy about interracial marriage was the Supreme Court decision in Loving versus Virginia, which struck down not only Virginia's law against marriages between people of different races, but effectively struck down the rest of those bans that were in place in other states. So we're working, as I said, on ballot campaigns as well as legislative campaigns and lawsuits in several parts of the country in an effort to bring freedom to marry to all Americans. And we don't know yet what the final resolution to that will be, but it could be another Supreme Court decision.
So if this lawsuit is successful, what would be the precedent that's set there in Virginia?
Well, for right now, we're looking forward to getting certification as a class action so that we can represent all of the thousands of couples who are affected by the Virginia discriminatory marriage laws right now. we expect to be proceeding for quite some time in the district court, building up a record to get evidence of all the different stories of harm from all the ways that couples are currently not having the protections and security of marriage made available to them. It's quite likely that this case will end up on appeal to the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals in Richmond, and then from there it's possible we could go on to the Supreme Court.
I want to thank you so much for joining us from the ACLU there on the East Coast. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
A federal judge in Wisconsin has granted sweeping immunity to the Catholic Church from those filing claims against it for sexual abuse by priests. The court had been tasked with deciding whether or not the church's transfer of over $50 million to a cemetery trust fund was a proper way to protect the sum from bankruptcy claims. A letter from 2007 from then Archbishop Timothy Dolan to the Vatican suggested the transfer was a means of preventing the sum from being included among the church's assets as it was facing an onslaught of lawsuits for sexual abuse by priests. As many as 45 priests from the Milwaukee area face allegations of sexual abuse. Among them, one is accused of molesting close to 200 boys. The decision by Judge Rudolph Randa is so broadly drafted that some people have interpreted the ruling as making it impossible for any victim to successfully sue any religious organization in court.
The Chevron Corporation has agreed to an out-of-court settlement ordering the company to pay $284,000 for pollution caused by its refinery in Salt Lake City, Utah. This amount equals just 1/1,000,000th of the company's annual earnings. One commentator pointed out that this is the equivalent of someone who makes $50,000 a year having to pay a fine of a nickel. The refinery was found to be producing excessive levels of nitrogen oxide, polluting the air in the surrounding area and creating acid rain. In addition to the small fine, Chevron will be required to put in pollution controls to reduce nitrogen oxide emissions. In agreeing to the terms, the Chevron Corporation did not admit guilt and claimed that its emissions were within permitted levels, but the Environmental Protection Agency documented excessive nitrogen emissions coming from the Utah refinery and charged the company with violating federal law.
A Canadian oil company has admitted that tar sands oil has been leaking for at least 2.5 months in Alberta, Canada. The location of the leaks is in the tar sands flats, the key location targeted for tar sands oil extraction to be shipped along the planned Keystone XL pipeline. In recent months, activists have stepped up a campaign to stop the pipeline, including a series of direct actions in dozens of states last Saturday, led by the environmental organization 350.org. In Alberta, the company known as Canadian Natural Resources Limited has not put together a strategy to address the leaks, saying that they just plan to wait it out and see what happens. Tar sands oil extraction is a difficult and messy process, and the amount of oil that's extracted through the process is very little more than the amount of energy put in to extract and make available the oil. In this case, several leaks have been identified beginning on May 20th, which have impacted wildlife across hundreds of acres in Alberta. The oil sludge is puddled in a number of spots, with more seeping underground and impacting an even larger area. The companies tracked the cause of the leaks to cases around wells drilled by the company and a previous contractor. An estimated 6,300 barrels have leaked so far, and the company says that the leak has now slowed down to around 20 barrels per day. But while the company may have identified the source of the leak, they're still unsure of the extent of the underground damage, since they've only been able to accurately measure the sludge that has come to the surface. The admission of the ongoing tar sands oil leak in Canada comes in the midst of a back-and-forth debate in Congress following President Obama's claim this past weekend that the proposed Keystone XL pipeline will create far fewer jobs than promised by the Republicans who are promoting the pipeline. If construction is completed, the Keystone XL pipeline will stretch from Alberta, Canada to Texas, impacting over a dozen states and transporting the unprocessed tar sludge through the United States to export terminals on the Texas coast. The State Department has received 1.2 million comments so far on its environmental impact statement, the vast majority of which are critical of the proposed pipeline.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, in eastern Nangarhar province, gunfire from a NATO helicopter mistakenly killed five Afghan police officers after the officers called for NATO air support. Last night, the Afghan officers' police checkpoint came under fire, prompting the request for NATO help. Details leading up to the NATO fire upon the policemen remain murky, and the above reports by spokespeople for U.S. coalition forces contradict earlier information on the attack from Afghan security officials. American officials state that they have launched an investigation into the incident.
And now, the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, August 1st, 2013. Israeli settlers and soldiers attack residents as a military court approves army evictions against farmers. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. A number of civilians were injured, another man kidnapped, when Israeli troops and settlers attacked on Thursday the village of Beit Umar near the southern West Bank city of Hebron. According to witnesses, the kidnapped man was beaten up before soldiers moved him away to a nearby military base. The attack started when Israeli armed settlers attacked villagers as they were taking part in a funeral. Later, Israeli troops invaded the village and attacked the residents alongside the settlers, witnesses told local news sources. Moreover, Israeli soldiers attacked and beat up a Palestinian journalist, Naif al-Hashlamon, as he was taking photos of the settlers and army attack. Staying in southern West Bank, the Israeli army court rejected a petition submitted by residents of Yatta Hills villages against Israeli army eviction orders. The army issued evictions to the residents because the military wants to conduct a training in the area that is used by local farmers and sheep herders. The court said on Thursday that the presence of some 1,300 villagers in the area will obstruct the work of the soldiers and drain resources. The court added that because the army are using new weapons, they need more ground for practice. According to the court, the residents could move to Yatta village as they have homes there. The residents' lawyers reported that the villagers have family relations with Yatta residents but do not live there, and they have documents proving that the farmers live in those villages for decades and work in farming and herding sheep. The lawyers also announced that evicting the residents is against international law, and they could go to the International Criminal Court of Justice if the army goes ahead with the evictions, local sources reported. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Thursday, August 1st news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Seamus Sloan White and me, Kassam Banmura.
Listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Robin Ryan and Sam Bowman. The producer is myself, Jen Chavez. Special thanks to reporter Jamie Partridge. Our engineer is Pat Epstein, and the KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Janka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You are listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm Jen Chavez.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Positively Revolting Talk Radio, Ani and Lynn talk about anarchism. At 9, APA Compass introduces a new segment called Heart to Heart with Ka. We hear a report on how both new and traditional media misidentified a missing Brown University student as the Boston Marathon bombing suspect. A look at a racist hoax following the crash of Asiana Flight 214. And an interview with author Jean Kwok about her novel, Girl in Translation. At 10, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, Shahid Hamid hosts a special interview with a call-in with Reverend Dr. Leroy Haynes Jr. of the Albina Ministerial Alliance Coalition for Justice and Police Reform. It will be on police accountability. It will be on the recent Supreme Court decision on Section 4 of the Voting Rights Act and plans for the 50th anniversary of the 1963 March on Washington, D.C. Thanks to all of you KBOO members for your generous support. If you're not a member yet, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Stay tuned now for more national and international news from the worker-run collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Jen.
Good night, Robert.
Good night, Pat.
Good night.
Okay.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, August 1st, 2013. In Kansas City, I'm Danny Wood.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Today, Edward Snowden left the Moscow airport a free man. Russia granted the accused NSA leaker 1 year of asylum, according to WikiLeaks, which is assisting Snowden. Snowden issued a statement through the whistleblower organization thanking Russia, saying, quote, "Over the past 8 weeks, we have seen the Obama administration